to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on a train hauling crude oil derailing in East Chicago. Indiana's 9 syringe exchange programs are set to expire in state law July 1st, 2021, but lawmakers pushed back the death sentence for the program by 1 year under legislation approved by the Senate committee. Jenny Lindsay reports on a key lawmaker scrapping a proposal to require teachers who carry guns in school to receive specialized training. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with NICTI President Michael Nolan. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. East Chicago officials say a freight train hauling tanker cars loaded with crude oil partially derailed in East Chicago after dozens of the cars disconnected from the rest of the train. Officials say 41 tanker cars somehow became disconnected Wednesday evening from the CXS train's conductor car, resulting in the derailment of several cars. Hazardous materials teams were sent to the site, but officials say no oil was spilled and no injuries were reported. The East Chicago Fire Department says between 5 and 10 cars needed to be uprighted following the accident. The cause of the derailment remains under investigation. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. 6 domestic battery charges have been dismissed against Lake County Recorder Michael B. Brown after his attorneys provided prosecutors with videos showing the alleged victim hitting him in front of children several times and defecating on his personal belongings. Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter said the videos undermined his office's ability to prosecute the case. The charges were dismissed Wednesday. The 36-year-old Hobart man was charged February 10th with 8 felony counts that also included criminal confinement and neglect of a dependent. Brown's attorney, Michael Woods, has said Brown is the victim in the case.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
An Indiana man who was holding his granddaughter before she fell from a cruise ship window and plunged to her death in Puerto Rico has agreed to a plea deal. Salvatore Anello says he wants to, quote, help end part of this nightmare. Attorney Michael Winkleman says Anello filed documents Monday in a Puerto Rico court to change his plea to guilty to a charge of neglect homicide in the death of 18-month-old Chloe last July. The attorney goes on to say Anello won't serve time behind bars. Royal Caribbean Cruises has said Anello was leaning out of an 11th floor window before he picked up the toddler and she slipped from his grip.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A Subaru plant in Northwest Indiana is set for a $158 million expansion that will create 350 new jobs by adding a new service parts facility and a transmission assembly shop. Subaru of Indiana Automotive announced both projects Wednesday for the plant's 820-acre Lafayette campus. Construction is expected to begin this summer. The plant, located about 60 miles north of Indianapolis, is Subaru's only.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
It employs more than 6,000 workers who built the Accent, Impreza, Legacy, and Outback models for North America. The plant began operations in 1989, and its production this year is projected to reach 410,000 vehicles.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
An Illinois contractor faces federal charges in Indiana for allegedly defrauding a blight removal program of nearly $100,000 with phony invoices. Mahmoud Mike Al-Shuabi was indicted by a grand jury on 6 felony counts of wire fraud, theft, and making false statements. He's the owner of Iesco Construction, Inc. of South Holland, Illinois. He surrendered Thursday at a hearing before Magistrate Judge John Martin. It was immediately unclear if he had an attorney. He's due in court March 6th. He's accused of stealing money from the Hardest Hit Fund, a federal program to demolish abandoned houses and eliminate urban blight.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Ivy Tech Community College announced a new apprenticeship program Wednesday that will place students in emerging career fields around internet-connected factory robots. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports the program is being funded by a nearly $4 million grant from the Department of Labor.
The program will run for 4 years and aims to put more than 3,000 apprentices in Indiana's manufacturing companies. Students will earn credentials in automation and robotics. It's part of a push some are calling the Fourth Industrial Revolution that focuses on automation and data collection. Sue Smith is the Vice President of Advanced Manufacturing, Engineering, and Applied Science at Ivy Tech. She says more advanced and internet-connected machines are already in many Indiana factories.
As a college, we need to make sure that our faculty, our labs, and our curriculum is where it needs to be to support this new technology.
The federal DOL grant was just one of 28 nationwide grants to create more apprenticeships between public schools and private employers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A parent advocacy group for Northwest Allen County Schools continued a series on education by bringing in State Education Superintendent Jennifer McCormick. She brought her unique perspective to issues dominating the education conversation in the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ella Abbott reports.
While education makes up over $9 billion of the state budget, Indiana is closer to the 50th than first in many important categories, and the ongoing teacher shortage is not slowing down. McCormick highlighted data that showed those disturbing trends.
If we have 35% of our teachers leaving in year 1 through 5, not leaving to go to another school, but leaving the profession, we are in trouble.
McCormick talked about a range of issues facing education in Indiana, such as a willingness to test for lead, but not how to fund cleaning up the problem. She also spoke about how arming teachers has been overemphasized and the lack of accountability for voucher and charter schools makes it impossible to track where taxpayer money is going. McCormick said these are examples of how education is over-legislated but under-prioritized.
At the end of the day, it has to be a priority and you have to fund it. You have to set aside the veterinary barns. You have to pause on the swine barns. You have to wait a minute on some roads. You're going to have to prioritize differently. And until that willingness is there, we're going to continue to talk this to death.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm
You're
Ella
listening
Abbott.
To Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A key lawmaker is scrapping a proposal to require teachers who carry guns in school to receive specialized training. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports on why the legislation is being dropped.
The bill that would require specialized training for teachers whose districts allow them to carry guns in school passed the Senate earlier this month. But lawmakers are nearing the end of the legislative session, and House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning says he won't offer the bill a hearing ahead of the committee deadline. He says the requirements in the bill were too narrow and would make it hard to access training.
Because of the specificity, it really may eliminate a lot of options in terms of providers.
Boehning is also nixing a bill that would have required every high schooler to file the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. But he says the FAFSA requirement will likely be moved into a different piece of legislation moving forward. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A revised bill that would address surprise medical billing passed the Senate Health Committee Wednesday.
But many senators say there's still a lot of work to be done. The bill would ensure patients will not face unexpected charges if, for example, they find out after a procedure that a doctor was out of network. Legislators nearly added a more than 30-page amendment to the bill. Among other things, it bans non-compete agreements and requires hospital systems to bill a patient based on the location the services took place. Senator Vannetta Becker says these are complex issues and the language needs to be reconsidered.
This bill, if it goes the way that it is right now, will have lots of unintended consequences. And I don't think the committee meeting that we ought to be voting something out of committee, that we don't not know the full ramification and consequences of that vote.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lawmakers pushed back the death sentence for Indiana's syringe exchange programs by 1 year under legislation approved by a Senate committee. Wednesday vote comes after the programs were put in jeopardy earlier this session. Indiana's 9 syringe exchange programs are set to expire in state law July 1, 2021. A bill earlier this year would have extended them indefinitely, but the Senate killed that measure. Now, lawmakers are trying again with a 1-year extension until July 2022. State Health Commissioner Chris Box says keeping the program alive is a must.
From 30 years of research, we know that syringe service programs reduce the number of new infections by providing testing, connecting patients to care, and providing sterile syringes to people until they're ready to enter treatment.
Clark County Health Director Eric Yazel says his county's program cut overdose deaths and emergency room visits in half.
You know, I'd love to stand up here someday and tell you that these programs aren't needed anymore. Unfortunately, today is not that day, and we're not even close.
The 1-year extension now goes to the full Senate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with NCDE President Michael Nolan.
There will be a series of public meetings going on this spring and summer here in Northwest Indiana to inform residents and property owners about the latest involving the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District's double track project, along with other projects too. Let's find out the latest from NCDE's President Michael Nolan. Mike, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Happy to be here, Chris.
Well, fill us in first. Give us an idea of, as the first series of conversations, I'm sure, will focus in primarily on the double tracking project, but I'm sure there may be some updates as well you can pass along on the Westlake Corridor project. But bring us up to date first on the double tracking.
Sure. We just got some great news out of the federal government here about 2 weeks ago, actually 2 weeks today. Mm-hmm. Double track was moved into the FTA's engineering phase of their capital investment grant project. And so what that means for us is FTA has done a thorough and in-depth analysis of the project. And when you enter engineering, that's their way of saying they want to fund the project. We've got some additional tasks to do before we actually get a grant, but FTA has given it their stamp of approval, and we're working towards getting a grant early next year, starting construction in 2021 and finishing up in late 2023. So it's a really exciting time for the double track project.
How much of a financial benefit will this bring us here in Northwest Indiana? We know the project is a sizable one as far as cost and expansion is concerned, but how is the grant from the federal government going to help?
Well, you know, it's a $420 million project, so the federal government's going to be in for around 38% of the overall cost. That's a sizable contribution from the FTA. In 2019, the state of Indiana stepped up and provided an extra up to $205 million in funding to assist us in moving both Westlake and Double Track to conclusion. And ultimately, the projects open up access to the region for Chicago and provide the opportunity for about $2.5 billion of private sector investment and around 5,000 jobs that will be created as a result of these projects once they're up and running.
I know the meeting, which is coming up this coming Wednesday, which is going to happen at City Hall in Michigan City, is the first of the series of public meetings, really, I guess, that start out in February and move on into March and then even move on even later into the year to bring people up to date with the project. Go through the list and fill us in as to what public meetings are going to happen when and which people should want to pay attention to the meetings the most.
Sure. Well, the first one we're going to do is with the Michigan City Council. A lot of the council has changed, Chris, since the time NICTI and Michigan City entered into an agreement 4 years ago for how the double track project was going to move forward. So we reached out to the council. We've had individual meetings with a number of them, and we've suggested that we have a public workshop where we just walk through what the double track project is going to mean, specifically as we go through Michigan City, because as you and I have talked before, there's major changes that the double track project is going to bring on 10th and 11th Street in Michigan City. There's property acquisition. There's a number of crossings that will be closed. The remaining crossings are going to see significant safety upgrades with full gates, lights, and bells. And there's going to be a major station building and renovation on 10th and 11th Street between Franklin and Pine. So we wanted to have the opportunity to have the time to sit down with the council in a public setting and go through what our plans are and answer any of the questions and then move forward together.
Now, fill us in on what the March public meetings are going to be all about, because they're not all in Michigan City. Some of them are going to be in Gary, I understand.
Sure. So the part of this aspect here is that we're going to be acquiring a fair amount of property. And what we have done is scheduled open houses for the affected property owners in Michigan City and in Gary and in other areas along the line. We did that when we started the acquisition in Westlake. Mm-hmm. And they proved to be very effective. To start with a general open house for those particular property owners, whether it be a homeowner or a renter or a business where we're going to be acquiring their property. And then we have individual meetings specific to the individual properties. But we're going to start off with these open houses for the affected property owners in Michigan City and Gary on the 3rd and the 4th of March.
Mm-hmm. I understand, too, that you'll have the consultant that's been working with NICTI on the real estate end of the project here, too. So if people have questions, the realtor, so to speak, the experts will be there to answer them.
Sure. Beam, Longus, and Neff, BLN, is the firm that we hired for both projects. So far, I think it's going very well on the Westlake property acquisitions. The process is designed to be very beneficial for the homeowner, and so we are encouraged to reach a resolution, and we've reached resolutions with over 90% of the folks on Westlake where we're acquiring property, and we're hoping to have the same result here on the double track side.
Okay. Now we go into the month of June, and I understand that NICTI has a number of public open houses that are going to be held in various cities. Tell us how that setup is going to be and what folks are likely to find out from those.
So we're at about a 30% engineering design at this point, Chris, and we've hired AECOM Engineering to take the design up to 100%. Before we get there, we're going to have the plan set at about 60%, and we're going to bring that vision to out so that people can take a look at it and provide us some of their thoughts. So that before, you know, if there's something that, you know, needs to be tweaked or modified, we've got a chance to do that before we get to final design. So that's what we're trying to do.
What kind of timetable are you still looking at here to get things started for first the double tracking and then, of course, for the Westlake Corridor projects?
Yeah, all things stay on schedule. We're looking to, for double track, get a full funding grant agreement from the federal government sometime late spring, early summer of 2021. And then we would immediately give a notice to proceed to a contractor to start building. And then we would hope to finish up by late 23 or early 2024 to start service on the double track. For Westlake, We're hoping to get a grant agreement from the federal government later this year, early fall, at which point in time we would then turn and give a notice to proceed to the design builder to start construction. Westlake's a larger construction project, so we would expect that that construction would be finished up in late 24 or early 25 for start of service on Westlake.
I was wondering that because the Westlake Corridor project is such a big one, and it's an area where you're not just adding tracks and expanding and making improvements like you, I suppose you are, I guess, with the double tracking project. Pretty much, that it's a lot more involved to be able to have to go north and south and then make the connection to the main lines, isn't it?
Yeah, the complicated thing about the Westlake project is there's a whole lot of aerial structure that has to be built as we go over the Grand Cal, or we go over Canadian National, we go over CSX, we cross over NS and Indiana Harbor Belt. And so there's a lot of aerial structure in this project that has to be built that just isn't the case on the double track project. So it is a much larger project.
Do you think it's probably going to be about as extensive, or maybe almost, or we'll see in that, as what NDOT had to do for the nine-span bridge in Hammond to go over a whole railroad yard, basically?
Well, I don't know.
Maybe not that big, so.
I don't know about that project, Chris. But I do know that this is a lot of aerial structure, and that's really what separates it between the double-track project that maybe is longer in length. We're building 8 miles of track for Westlake, and we're building 16 miles for double track, but the double track really doesn't have the aerial component to it. That's what really complicates that.
Do you think that, I'm sure people have probably had their comments up to this point, and certainly will make more during these series of public meetings coming up here for this one, this particular month, and then into March and into the summer months. Do you think that, that folks have had a better idea now that more information is out there and more will be out there to get an idea for themselves as what this is really going to look like?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, as you know, we did numerous public meetings in 2016 and 2017 while we were advancing the project 30% design and to finish up our requirements of the National Environmental Protection Act. So we've already received a lot of public input, both from individuals and from communities up and down the line, and we're hoping to get more, and that we are looking for constructive input that can make the project better. So ultimately, that's where we're trying to go.
All right, Mike, fill us in on what websites people can go to take a look at not only the double tracking project but also the latest involving the Westlake Corridor project.
Sure. We've got individual project update sections on the South Shore Line website itself. Mm-hmm. So if you go to mysouthshoreline.com and you go to the tab that says About, there's individual tabs that will take you to the Double Track Project or the Westlake Corridor Project, and they're both chock full of information on prior presentations, news about the projects, documents about the projects, the NEPA evaluation. And so you can go through and find a whole host of information about each of the projects just by going to mysouthshoreline.com and then going to the About tab.
Have you had an opportunity, certainly you get to meet with the contractors, the design people, as well as the people that are going to be doing the most work on both the double tracking and on the Westlake Corridor projects? Do you think that they're just taking the opportunity now and waiting to hear more, maybe in the last minutes, so to speak, from the public before they really start to go to work and really get going because you've got the deadlines coming up?
Yeah, well, you know, we went out for an RFP for design build services for Westlake in 2018. Mm-hmm. And at the January board meeting of NCDE here in 2020, we determined the current apparent best value proposer, the FH Passion team, to build the Westlake project. So we've got a proposal from Passion. We're in the midst of negotiations to try to get to an agreed upon construction price and scope. And so we're working right now with the FH Passion team for the double track project. There's been a lot of interest expressed, we know, from the construction community. And I think there's going to be a fairly competitive process once the construction bids are put on the street And we anticipate, Chris, that we'll put the double track project on the street for construction bids right around the first of the year, January 21.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great to know. We've been all watching and waiting to find out more, and we'll actually get to see some construction crews get out there and start work on the projects, to be sure. We've been talking with Michael Noland, who's the president of the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, about the latest on the double track and the Westlake Corridor projects for the South Shore Line Commuter Railroad. And Mike, as always, thank you for spending time and going through all the details for us. We appreciate it.
No problem, Chris. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.